Hey everybody, it's James from the future here with a quick content notice about this episode. This is an episode about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and that means that I'm going to talk about the Fimir, starting about 6 minutes, 30 seconds, 6:45, something like that. Since I am discussing the Fimir, that means that there's going to be some references to sexual violence. If you want to skip that stuff, if you just jump ahead about 30 seconds to a minute, you'll miss the whole thing. Just want to let you know in case you wanted to avoid that. All right, on with the show. Monster Man, special episode, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular of Patreon backer Stan. Now, Stan has asked me to talk about a classic game from the 80s, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. If you'd like to be like Stan and get your own special episode about a monster, or in this case, collection of monsters of your choice, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for lower levels, including at the $2 level, my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Stan, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. All right, first up, a little background. When we think of Warhammer, we tend to think of the miniature war games that came to dominate the miniature wargaming hobby. Like, I don't have the figures, but it would not surprise me to find out that Games Workshop's war game sales are not only equal to, but significantly greater than all of its competitors put together. For a lot of people, miniature wargaming means Warhammer. But in the mid-80s, I don't know that that was necessarily true. Well, in fact, I know that it wasn't. Games Workshop, which is kind of the central upright of the British gaming industry, was going through kind of a transitional phase, moving away from role-playing games and moving in the direction of being a company that primarily makes miniatures games. And that transition's going to happen over a pretty short period of time. And sort of the one weird exception to it is going to be this game. But here in the mid-80s, we kind of get these three releases that are going to define Warhammer, right? So we have Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Warhammer Fantasy Battle 3rd Edition, and Warhammer 40,000 Rogue Trader, which we talked about a couple of episodes ago. Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay plays a very important part in the development, particularly, I think, of British gaming. I think for a lot of British gamers, this is their AD&D. And it reflects, in many ways, the preferences, I think, of a British audience who maybe saw the kind of heroic adventuring of AD&D as, you know, fine, but they wanted something that was a little more sarcastic. Kind of the tone of Warhammer is a bit different, where there was a little more, not realism, but kind of the aesthetic of realism, of grubbiness, and that had more kind of investigative and political elements. And of course, Warhammer would really come to be defined by its big campaign, The Enemy Within, which is still, you know, there are people out there who will tell you that Masks of Nyarlathotep is the greatest role-playing game campaign, and those are people who, like, have some kind of strange vocal defect that prevents them from saying the phrase, The Enemy Within. You know, and I think Warhammer both reflected and shaped the preferences of that British gaming public, which is a point that isn't, I think, noticeably different today, right? You know, even within the Anglophone gaming world, I think it is clear that there are certain games that are disproportionately popular in Britain. And that sense of, and I don't know if that's the result of the influence of Warhammer, or it's a result of the cultural forces that created Warhammer, but I do think they're connected. But if we simply confine ourselves to looking at the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st Edition rulebook, we're going to see something that is maybe a little different from what we expect, right? If your understanding of Warhammer is based, you know, kind of mainly on The Enemy Within, then I think you're going to be surprised when you look at the 1st Edition bestiary, because there's some things that you might not expect. So let's take a look. The Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st Edition bestiary is divided into six categories. You got humanoid creatures, animals and monsters, undead, ethereal undead, elementals, and demons. And we're really only going to talk about three of those categories. First, let's take a look at the humanoid creatures. The humanoid creatures has pretty much what you'd expect in it. Humans, elves, dwarves, goblins, hobgoblins, lizard men. It's got troglodytes, which in this game are an extremely large version of lizard men, like 10 feet tall. And it, like, I genuinely never realized this they're Croxagore, right? The Croxagore are troglodytes. You have no idea what I'm talking about. But in Lizardmen armies in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, there are very large, powerful Lizardmen called Croxagore, and they're clearly what used to be troglodytes. I never got that because there are no troglodytes in my Wuffrup game, because we didn't go to Lustria because we were playing, you know, dirty investigations down the back alleys of Marienburg or whatever, because that's what the game would come to be. But note that that's not necessarily what the designers here are talking about. But I think that the two standouts of the humanoid creature section are the ones that you wouldn't also find in a D&D manual. And those are, of course, the Fimir and the Skaven. Zoats are not in here, presumably because they're not humanoid. But I don't know. I always think, when I think Fimir, I always think Zoats must go with them. But we'll talk about the Zoats in a bit. So one thing that's really noticeable about the Fimir is that they have a really long section compared to the other humanoids. And this kind of tells us a little bit about what the writers are assuming that the readers know, right? Like that they know what an orc is. They know what a goblin is. They know what an elf or a dwarf or a halfling. You know, those are all relatively well understood concepts within the genre of dungeon fantasy, which, not to forget, has been around for a decade by this point. More than a decade. Lizard men are lizards, but also men. People. But they're called lizard men. That's what they're called. But the Fimir are new, and therefore they get a big entry and a big kind of like illustration that shows sort of different types of them and whatever. There has been some suggestion that the Fimir might be making a comeback in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, or, well, Warhammer the Old World or Age of Sigmar or one of the modern GW games, I don't know. But I would be surprised if it was in their current form, because there is some sexual violence in the Fimir section, right? Like Fimir, you know, raid human settlements as part of their reproductive process, which I don't think would fly today. I think that would maybe not be seen as appropriate for a basic part of this creature in a fantasy role-playing game. I've discussed this issue before when I talked about the brew. You know, everything I said there, I apply also to the Fimir. But in terms of their look and everything, they're a classic of monster design. It's strange that they were included in HeroQuest, of all things. But GW spent a good amount of time trying to make the Fimir happen, and they never quite took off. Partly, I think, because in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, they were rubbish. They were very cash expensive for how good they were in the game. The other standout monsters in here are the Skaven. I think the Skaven are highly underrated as role-playing game antagonists, and ironically, it's kind of the success of their branding that has done that. Because the Skaven are, you know, when we think of the Skaven, so if you don't play Warhammer, Skaven are kind of humanoid rats, and they have this kind of like wacky technology aspect to them. So there are, you know, Skaven who throw toxic gas bombs. There are Skaven with like magical flamethrowers. And their technology is not super reliable necessarily. And they're very kind of like, and they're led by these very kind of like scheming villain characters. And they, in the miniatures game, they have this rule where the more of them there are, the braver they are. They get a big bonus to their leadership if they're in large units, but the rest of the time they're quite cowardly. They're very interesting and fun. And, you know, when I think of the Skaven, kind of the Felix and Gotrek stories are what spring to mind, right? Gotrek and Felix are kind of the like iconic adventuring heroes of the Warhammer universe, and they spend a lot of time chasing Skaven around the sewers. Indeed, I think that's where the sort of iconic Skaven character, Grayseer Thankwall, and his rat ogre sidekick Bone Ripper come from. Now, the series of stories by Bill King. So the Skaven like are organized into sinister conspiracies. They live in sewers. They have weird gadgets. There are lots of different types of Skaven, all with different abilities. They really are kind of ideal RPG monsters in a lot of ways, but their application is limited essentially because their branding is so successful, and kind of there's no uncovering the conspiracy of the Skaven. Everybody knows what Skaven are. You know, if you're playing Warhammer Fantasy, you expect to run into some Skaven. And you're going to have fun because they're going to be doing all the Skaven stuff, firing weird experimental weapons and going, "Die, die, man things!" and whatever. Like, and it's fun, but the nature of Warhammer Fantasy Battle wound up kind of fossilizing a lot of Warhammer Fantasy roleplay monsters. That's a long discussion that this podcast does not have room for. Okay, our next section is animals and monsters. A lot of kind of like what you'd expect. There's some dungeon monsters, there's slimes and molds, there's a lot of kind of mythological monsters, your hydras and chimeras and unicorns and so forth. Standouts for me here include the blood sedge, a vampiric hedge, the bog octopus, The Camellia Leech, which is kind of a mimic by another name. The Razorbill, which is sort of a deadly puffin. And a lot of worm monsters. Also, the Zote, an intelligent creature, is in here for some reason. Here's the introduction to the bog octopus section. Most octopi are relatively harmless, if not enchanting, aquatic creatures, which live for the most part in tropical oceans. The bog octopus, however, is not of this ilk. It has the look of a huge octopus with 8 tentacles, huge red eyes, and green skin, but there the resemblance ends. These creatures live in the cold and forbidding marshes and bogs of the old world. Their entire lives are spent squelching menacingly around in stinking mud and quagmires, surfacing occasionally to drag down and eat some passing creature. Living in such a dense medium, they are incredibly strong, and once caught by a tentacle, it is very hard for all but the strongest creatures to escape. That tone, squelching and bogs and quagmires and whatever, that's very kind of what you'd expect, I think, from the tone of this game. There's a dragon turtle, which you wouldn't expect, and I think I'll explain why there's a dragon turtle when we get to the next section. And there's a Jabberwock, I think, for much the same reason. Well, I said the next section, but I actually meant the next section I'm going to talk about, because I'm going to pretty much skip the undead, ethereal undead, and elemental sections, because I think there's nothing in here that you wouldn't expect. Although you may think, huh, I didn't know there were elementals in Warhammer. Well, they kind of aren't. But there were at this point. Okay, now for the demons section. Oh boy, demons. This is Warhammer, so we know we're in for some good demons. I can't wait to read out about all my favorites, like the Lord of Change and the Great Unclean One. Let's get to the... Wait, what? What is this? This demon section is very short for Warhammer. And of course, this is a great example of how Warhammer was not always Warhammer, right? Just like the warp creatures in Warhammer 40,000, the demons in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay are not what they would become. We are waiting on the release of Realm of Chaos Slaves to Darkness, which comes out in 1988, I want to say. So we've actually got a couple of years to go before the mythology of chaos, which is such an important part of the Warhammer Old World, you know, actually appears. In this section, we get kind of generic demons, lesser and greater, and we get the Baalruch, which is similar to, but legally distinct from, a Balrog, or indeed a Balor. We also have the Mabrathrax, or Plague Elemental, the Mardag, or Death Elemental, and the Vidag, or Life Elemental. And it says these are sometimes erroneously called Life and Death Elementals, and the reason they're erroneously called that is the same reason that I think a lot of these creatures are in here, which is that that is what their miniatures are called. The Mardag and the Vidag, indeed, would need to both be together, since they come in the same packet. They are part of the C-34 Elementals and Demons range, which was out by spring 1985, so predates this game. Because remember that Warhammer Fantasy Battle is originally a much more generic system. Or maybe not generic, but open and accessible, right? There are published scenarios that go into more detail about the old world and about Lustria in particular, but also it's clearly intended to be a game where you can play out your fantasy fights. You know, fantasy, elves, dwarves, orcs, that kind of thing. And so obviously it has elementals. And this is, it's interesting to see 35 years later, do we have air elementals? Do you mean Huracan wind chargers? Actually, Huracan wind chargers are elves who ride kind of like kangaroo dinosaurs, but never mind that. But GW have clearly decided that kind of open fantasy approach is not where they want to go with the line. And that's, not that there's anything wrong with that. But I think that there is some sense here that when people were thinking what kind of monster ought to go in the monster section, someone sat down and had a look at the miniatures catalog, maybe. I don't know to what extent this reflects the bestiary of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, or to what extent those two projects are proceeding in tandem. Obviously, there is some effort to keep the rule systems compatible. I don't know that that actually was ever that much of a thing, but it's certainly a goal that people kind of tried to achieve. So, one thing you see with a lot of games, when you look back at their older editions, is that they are maybe not exactly the game that they finally wind up being. And that I don't even mean as they progress through different editions and different releases, but I mean that it kind of took the Enemy Within scenarios, indeed even kind of the one in here, the Olden Holler Contract, sort of sets the tone in a way that maybe the rules of the game itself don't necessarily. There wasn't going to be all that much dungeon adventuring in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay world. That games were going to have, there's a certain amount, right? Is it Death on the Reich that is the Frankenstein's monster knockoff? That's the castle is a bit of a dungeon, but that is not going to be the primary focus of this game with all its rat catchers and highwaymen and agitators. So I think in that sense, it's true that the actual Warfront First Edition rulebook doesn't necessarily produce the Warfront that you remember when you remember Warfront, or at least that most people do. But on the other hand, I think it's not unconnected. We can clearly see that there is some element of the games, you know, that the game's aesthetics remain kind of consistent, even right down to the sort of like crunchy old-fashioned fonts. Like, this comes out the same year as Creature Catalog, but Creature Catalog looks like it's from a decade later in terms of its presentation, right? The kind of consciously old-timey presentation of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay contributes, I think, to a certain reading aesthetic. This may just be me speaking personally. For me, the kind of like the edition of Call of Cthulhu that is like the edition is fourth. And there was something about the design of the fourth edition books. They're not like typographically or design like old-timey like Warfront is, but there's something fussy about the way that they're presented that gives this sense of like scholarliness. Like, hey, you're reading the Thinking Gamers RPG. And that really appealed to me when I was younger because I was both a nerd and a snob. So yeah, I think there's something of this aesthetic that you can connect to kind of earlier British gaming in general, right? That you can connect to Fiend Factory, that you can connect to Fighting Fantasy, that this sort of embrace of the grotesque and certain types of the absurd continues. And no wonder, you know, the same people are going from TSR UK to working on Warfront. So there's that as well. I think, you know, whatever aesthetic decision means that there are so many worm monsters in this bestiary, there's a surprising number of worms. A fen worm, a gold worm, a lash worm, a sun worm, right? It's a surprising number of wormy creatures. And that makes a lot of sense to me. There aren't heroic images of adventurers in these sections. The animals and monsters section has a few pictures of adventurers, and in some of them, they're just like squaring up to the monster. That's what the spider comma giant image looks like. It's just someone, you know, getting ready to fight a spider comma giant. But in the snake comma giant, we've got an adventure being constricted. In the sand clam, we've got an adventure stepping in the sand clam and getting his foot caught. In the leech comma monstrous, we've got an adventurer sinking into a bog. In the dragon, we've got a dwarf running away from the dragon. In the camellia leech, we've got a lady. Oh, maybe that's a camellia leech imitating a lady, actually. I thought it was a lady, like, unaware that a camellia leech was about to bite her. But actually, I think the camellia leech is the lady. In the blood sedge, we've got an adventurer getting his blood drunk by the blood sedge. And in the beetle comma giant, we've got someone facing off with it. And the amoeba, someone trying to fend it off, right? Like, in general, we're not seeing images of adventurers as terribly heroic, you know? And I think that sense of like, oh, people are in trouble is consistent throughout. Another thing that I think you can look at in terms of the aesthetic of a section is what's not in it, right? Unlike the diverse monster manual, the bestiary doesn't have every possible kind of monster in it. It focuses on some at the expense of others. So for example, think of how many fairy type monsters there are in AD&D, and there are none in here, right? There are there's dwarves, elves, gnomes, goblins, halflings, hobgoblins. So there are lots of kind of, you know, fairy tale-y creatures, but there are no like little sprightly nature spirits. There really is a big difference considering that the bestiary is otherwise sufficiently indebted to D&D that it has stats for like herd animals. There are a few plants, although there are some, you know, but this is a game where maybe the emphasis is not as much on wilderness adventure, right? It's set in a settled landscape. Now, a cynic might say that there are a lot of monsters in here that could be represented by miniatures, and that's fair enough. Whether that's the reason for this choice or not, I feel like the setting has a certain materiality to it. Maybe that's a connection to like the game sort of tied to the horror genre, but there are a lot of monsters that could be represented by a miniature, and that means that there's a lot of monsters that are kind of on human scale. There are far fewer like really gigantic monsters in this game, and that lends it a sort of more grounded feel. And then I think that the way outness of the Realm of Chaos books will produce a pleasing contrast to the otherwise kind of like, you know, worrying about whether you need a pair of new shoes, my halberd haft gives me splinters aesthetic that will come to characterize Warhammer. So I think that that produces an interesting contrast with all the gonzo magic stuff. You know, looking at the bestiary, it seems to me that the things that make this distinctively Warhammer are really the Skaven and the Fimir. Your orcs are pretty much conventional fantasy. Quite a lot of this is, you know, like very much things that one would expect to find in a fantasy game. And we are in a period, I guess, where Warhammer is still very much another lens with which to look at a shared heritage of fantasy gaming, rather than something that is very much a distinctive brand in its own right. You know, you can definitely see that with the current Warhammer Battle product, Age of Sigmar, where they're trying to make everything look distinctive. So, you know, no more just like there are like steampunk airship dwarves and there are like Mohawk dinosaur dwarves. Yes, we're still gonna have elven spears and elven horsemen because we have to have those things, but there's a lot more like elf floating in the air next to his sphinx friend. You know, this is my new elf unit, the Flying Zen Garden. You know, and that makes the game unique rather than an example of a type. But I think here, this is a spin on the genre of D&D. Perhaps a new way of looking at it, connected perhaps to other British games of the era. Neither merely another D&D-esque fantasy RPG, nor completely its own thing yet. And that's really interesting. So yeah, that is my look at the bestiary of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st Edition. Stan, I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Stan and get your own special episode, remember what I said at the top. All you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or if you'd prefer to pledge at another level, that's cool too. If you'd like to support the show, but you don't want to do so financially, and believe me, I understand, it would be great if you could leave a review or a rating on the podcasting app of your choice, or just tell a friend who you think might enjoy it. In our next episode, hopefully, depending on how much editing I've been able to do this week, it's a busy month, we're going to be doing another one of our My Favorite Monster specials, in which I sit down with the game creator and we talk about monsters. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.